The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled Feminist Future, the Pioneering Kumbahayi River Collective Statement Forever Changed Black Feminism. I stumbled upon the Kumbahayi River Collective statement in a quest to fill a void. I was excited to begin the first year of my master's program at Howard University and to engage with literature on black politics. That quickly turned to disappointment. The majority of our readings focused on cis heterosexual men. Rarely did we discuss the contributions of black women. Reading the pioneering text changed the trajectory of my life and solidified my identity as a black feminist. It also changed the trajectory of black feminist politics as a whole. The statement was written in April 1977 by Barbara Smith, Beverly Smith, and Demita Frazier, founding members of the Kumbahayi River Collective, a black feminist, lesbian, and socialist organization active in Boston from 1974 to 1980. It is now considered to be one of the foundational documents of revolutionary black feminism. We felt very strongly there needed to be something out there that broke down what we meant by black feminism, Beverly Smith says, describing what had felt like a glaring omission in the framing of feminism at that time. In a way, we were also theorizing and analyzing what we saw black feminism meaning to other black women too. Political practices do not emerge out of thin air. They have origins. This can be said too of the statement's co-authors, whose feminist beginnings are rooted in leftist liberation movements. At a young age, twin sisters Barbara and Beverly Smith were active in the civil rights movement, organizing for school desegregation in their hometown of Cleveland. Born and raised in Chicago, Demita Frazier was in high school when she organized a student walkout to oppose the Vietnam War. Later, she was associated with the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party, as well as the Jane Collective, which helped women access safe abortions at a time when the procedure was illegal. Like many other black women, Barbara, Beverly, and Demita were familiar with the racism and sexism that plagued the era's various movements. Disillusioned with the patriarchal politics of black nationalist groups and the racism of white women in feminist spaces, they sought to build community with other black women who wanted to center and affirm their identities and experiences. In 1973, when Beverly worked as a staff writer at Miss Magazine, she met one of its early editors, Margaret Sloan Hunter. At the time, Sloan Hunter was planning a conference in New York City for the National Black Feminist Organization, NBFO, which she co-founded. Sloan Hunter invited the Smith sisters to the conference, where they met other black women from the Boston area, and later Barbara and other women in the Boston area established the Boston chapter of the NBFO. However, the chapter was disbanded due to its members frustration with what they saw as the national group's bourgeoisie feminist stance and their lack of a clear political focus. In 1974, some of the Boston women went on to found the Combahee River Collective. It was named in honor of Harriet Tubman and her famed leadership. During the Combahee Ferry Raid of 1863, when she and 150 African American soldiers freed 750 enslaved Africans in South Carolina during the Civil War. The new group's members included such activists and artists as Cheryl Clark, Audre Lorde, Shirlane McRae, and Margot Ray. 3 years later, Barbara, Beverly, and Demita drafted the Combahee River Collective Statement to establish their political mission and, more importantly, to center Black feminism as the logical political movement to combat the manifold and simultaneous oppressions that all women of color face. I had a need to articulate why it was important for Black women to be equal partners in the struggle for our mass liberation. Demita says now, equal partners means equity and not being restrained in any way from showing our brilliance. What distinguished the statement from other texts of its time was its explicit socialist lens, with a demand to end capitalist economic domination, a commitment to coalition politics, and an unrelenting solidarity with global anti-imperialism movement. In 1978, the statement was published in Zilla Einstein's book, Capitalist Patriarchy and the Case for Social Feminism. Our overall message was that it is not possible to challenge Black women's oppression using an individualistic approach. Barbara says, we wrote about interlocking systems of oppression that needed to be challenged simultaneously through strategic political organizing. As socialists, we understood that capitalism was the driver of vast inequality, injustice, and exploitation in the United States and globally. This framework preceded what we now call intersectionality, which refers to the interconnected nature of systems of inequality. The trailblazing Combahee document also introduced another concept that has been contentiously debated, identity politics. The co-authors define identity politics as the belief that the most profound and potentially most radical politics come directly out of our own identity, as opposed to working to end somebody else's oppression. More recently, as the term has been distorted by far-right conservatives, the authors have sought to set the record straight. We used the term to assert that we had the right to formulate our own political agenda, Barbara states. We never thought that focusing solely on aspects of our identity was sufficient to build a political practice and movement. During the lifespan of the Combahee River Collective, members organized around issues ranging from reproductive justice to violence against women. Before disbanding in 1980, one of the group's most notable campaigns was raising awareness about the serial murders of 12 Black women in Boston, demanding police accountability and media coverage of the murders. While today many Black women and gender expansive people can more readily proclaim a Black feminist identity When Barbara, Demita, and Beverly were writing this statement, it was not yet quote-unquote cool to be a black feminist. In fact, they endured the starkest exclusion because of it. During that time, you could not even say that you were a black feminist and have a civil conversation, Beverly recalls. Barbara agrees. People do not realize how contested black feminism was at that time, she says. We were under attack. Black feminism was in no way acceptable to mainstream black politics. The good thing is there are actually many black feminisms, Demita adds, noting that much has changed in the decades since they authored the pioneering document. In this vein, the Combahee River Collective statement has taught us so many invaluable lessons. As a political blueprint, it has taught black feminists that our lives, leadership, and legacies matter. It has taught us that black feminists are not political addendums, but rather agents and conspirators of revolutionary leftist transformation. Translated across languages, cited worldwide, and inspiring millions, it has given black feminists the space to assert our resistance, our pain, and even our joy boldly. It still is and will always be a profound intervention and a testament to the power, possibilities, and future of black feminist freedom politics. The next article is titled Fallen Snow. As snowfall prepares for its final act, the actresses at the heart of its story reflect on the beauty of their character's journey. The tale of Franklin Saint and the empire he built on pure white rock unfolds like a neo-Western empire saga on snowfall, though criminally ignored by prestige television awards committees. The show shockingly received 0 prime time Emmy nominations in the acting or screenwriting categories in any of its previous 5 seasons. The FX series has captivated critics and organically acquired a loyal fan base since its premiere on July 5th, 2017, often dismissed as just another popular urban crime melodrama, the series marks the final work from John Singleton, who died just 3 seasons in after a sudden stroke on April 28, 2019. The program separates itself from the cacophony of gunfire and gang plays that characterize your average drug narrative by unflinchingly staring the viewer in the eye and delivering truths, some harsh, some joyous, all fully authentic, about the rise of the crack cocaine epidemic in Los Angeles in the 1980s. While the show's main plot remains centered on the rise of the burgeoning drug lord Saint, played by British Nigerian Damson Idris, and the interwoven tales of his entry into the game, the players across South Central LA and Central America and the U.S. government's dubious involvement therein, many of the movements that stick come from the supporting narratives of the women within their orbit. These women include the long-suffering single mother trying to instill morality and the value of hard work in her young son, while the streets offer a faster, more dangerous path to money. The girl next door turned neighborhood dope fiend, and the party girl who became a top lieutenant in the drug trade and now threatens to claim a crumbling empire as her own. As the mothers, spouses, queen pins, and addicts that both feed and fought the spread of crack throughout the black community, actresses Michael Hyatt, Angela Lewis, Gail Bean, Devin Tyler, and Rain Edwards have expertly added layers of nuance to the stories of quick wealth, bloodshed, and the addiction that fuels it all. Now, after facing a slew of moral conflicts while fighting to keep her integrity intact and her son alive, Hyatt says she's prepared for the bittersweet goodbye to her pivotal role as Franklin's mother, Sissy Saint. Michael Hyatt, I am ready to let go because this is what John's intentions was, Hyatt says. Especially now that we no longer have him, it was always important for me to maintain the integrity John wanted. He left an indelible mark on my consciousness, my understanding of who I was as an artist in this industry, and what was possible as a person of African descent in this industry, she adds tearfully. He broadened my understanding of myself. Gail Bean. In the role of Wanda Bell, Bean portrays a once bright-eyed drug dealer girlfriend who becomes the local addict. Now on track, back to sobriety after nearly drowning in the painful depths of addiction, the character reveals a journey that's an example of the thin line so easily tripped across, one that permanently changed many thriving black communities at the turn of the century. I really wanted to show that we are not much different from one another, Bean explains of her role. Sometimes we are one incident or one party or one last job away from an unfortunate situation. Describing her and her colleagues' storytelling as the highest and purest form of art, she adds, there were so many moments where our writers so bravely did not shy away from the truth. We didn't do things for the shock factor, where it would have been easy to wade into stereotypes of the black women who raise drug dealers, partner with them, or use their product. Snowfall has shown these women's stories in full color. Devin Tyler. There's so much life that happens in between the chaos, says Tyler, joining the cast in season 5 as Veronique Turner, Franklin's lawyer and lover and mother to his unborn child. The actress relishes the opportunity to express the fullness of this particular human experience. I think it's really important to acknowledge that there is life in there, there is love in there, and there is perseverance in there, she says. In all circumstances and in all aspects of life, there's always love, there's always relationships, there's always family. I think it's easy for us to forget that. The on-screen family bonds are echoed in the behind-the-scenes sisterhood these actresses are able to find with one another on set. Though each of their characters' arcs are essential threads in the overall tapestry of the show, the women rarely had the opportunity to play against one another. It was a treat for both the audience and the actresses when Bean and Edwards were able to connect in season 3 to demonstrate the rapid downward spiral Edwards' character, Melody Wright, experienced after one run-in with crack at a party. Rain Edwards. We studied so much together and prayed so much together, Edward says of her time with Bean. She recalls how before his death, Singleton, aiming to pull the highest level of performance out of his actors, arranged for the actresses to meet with members of his family and community who had lived through addiction. It was so beautiful to be able to do that, Edwards adds. I'm just grateful to have been a part of it. Angela Lewis, as Luann Saint, known more affectionately as Aunt Louie, Lewis has had perhaps the most drastic character arc from the show's inception to its looming finale. As her nephew's first lieutenant, she's spent the better part of the storytelling, supporting and facilitating Franklin's drug empire dreams. But fans were shocked at the end of last season when she finally made a play strictly out of self-interest. Last season was all about Louie realizing and then deciding she's got to do some things for herself, Lewis says. It pissed a lot of people off, and that's okay. Sometimes you have got to make some people mad in order to shine your brightest. And I think that's what she did. Initially, Lewis had to dig deep to access a broken, hardened character like Louie and comprehend her decision-making. But she quickly discovered that, as with the show's other characters, the focus had to remain on the humanity at her core. I did a deep dive in a meditation, and I discovered that she really was a full human being who had had her heart broken over and over and over again, Lewis says. I promised her that I was going to take care of her, that I was going to bring her humanity to the forefront. For each of these actresses, humanity is the common thread that has kept them delivering raw, honest, powerhouse performances that speak to the conscious memory of a time past and the cultural shift it caused that reverberates to this day. And within that narrative, one constant remains. I think the biggest thing is just knowing the strength of a Black woman, the fierceness of a Black woman, our ability to overcome, Bean says. Reflecting on the experience of creating this masterpiece of television drama, Hyatt adds, you have to let it be, come what may, and just trust and love yourself and love the journey through it. That's been Sissy. That's been Michael. That's been Snowfall. That's been Mom. That's been all of it. Sissy is just a representation of me and so many me's. That is the beauty of the story. The next article is titled Out and About. In partnership with Coca-Cola, Essence brought Black women in sports to the Celebration Bowl festivities in Atlanta, Georgia. The unprecedented awards brunch provided a safe space for insightful conversation and put a spotlight on leading Black women in the sports industry, both professional and collegiate. Host L. Duncan warmed up the crowd and set the tone for an amazing experience celebrating Black women and their contributions to sports. What is better than one woman at the Black Woman in Sports Awards brunch? 2. Delaware State University women's lacrosse team coach Pamela Jenkins accepted a recognition plaque on behalf of the team and their resilience in the face of adversity. DJ Tracy Steele on the ones and twos, spinning the best hits to keep the crowd moving and grooving. Essence Black Women in Sports honorees Sanya Richards Ross track and field superstar, and Sonja Steele's commissioner at Mid-Eastern Atlantic Conference. Leading ladies of HBCU sports, Peggy Davis, Alicia Gadsden Shields, and Tara Owens, joined sportscaster Maria Taylor for a candid conversation about the past, present, and future of Black women and HBCU athletes. Sanya Richards Ross joined Essence Ventures President and CEO Caroline Wanga for an honest discussion around her journey to becoming a global track and field star athlete and life after realizing her professional sports dream. Coca-Cola Zero Sugar Bar, featuring unforgettable signature cocktails, Black Girl Magic was in full effect when attendees hit the dance floor for the Cuff It Challenge. The next article is from BlackEnterprise.com, and the title of the article is North Carolina's First Black-Owned Children's Bookstore Set to Open Its Doors for the First Time, and Liberation Within the Community and the African Diaspora. I feel so incredibly blessed, Scott Miller, a literacy advocate, author, business owner, and mother of two, told the news outlet. It makes me feel so full because I never envisioned getting a brick and mortar. She added, "We were the first Black-owned bookstore we ever set foot in." She said, "To know that we have carved out a space in the universe for our children to feel safe and to be able to be curious, to be joyful, it's overwhelming to think about. From the Duke Gardens and Durham Hotel to the North Carolina Museum of Art, Liberation Station has been on the move with a mission since 2019. Now they are using funds raised through their crowdsourcing efforts, including a partnership with the Bulls of Durham, to help them outfit the 364-square-foot store at 208 Fayetteville Street. That vision began out of the trunk of our car and then migrated to pop-ups all around the triangle, then to our permanently housed narratives inside of the Durham Hotel and Duke Gardens. But we soon realized that we didn't need a lot of space to make a big impact, and then Liberation was born. The Millers are anticipating a grand opening on June 19th, Juneteenth, a federal holiday commemorating the emancipation of enslaved people. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.